Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the hosts and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have a problem with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West and a guest in the Panhandle, transmitting across the internet, this is episode 70 of Registry Matters. Larry, what's up?
Well, I'm just suffering through this horrible allergy season.
Oh, but, yeah.
I'll make it.
You will. I don't know if I've brought this up before, but so here in this state with what you're referring to, a friend of mine moved into town and he was shocked at all the yellow pollen. And there's no way that I can actually say this word and keep this a family oriented program, but he called it tree and then some sort of after effect. And I'll leave it at that, but he called it tree something. And because it's everywhere, you end up with it like on the sidewalls of your tires, and there's just yellow gunk everywhere. And then when it rains, it collects everywhere. It's disgusting. It's terrible.
It's even worse in Florida.
Everything's worse in Florida.
So we just invented a new word today. Worse.
Yes, you can look that up, and I can guarantee you that it's actually a legit thing. Speaking of Florida, Mike, welcome. You are from the Panhandle State. How are you?
I'm good, guys. Glad to be here.
Appreciate having you on, and like we just said, you're from the Panhandle State. You've been an incredibly long-time Patreon supporter, and I can't thank you enough for that, and you helped support the podcast. And that's not, you know, you didn't buy your way onto the podcast, but you had an interesting series of questions that we're going to get to here in a little bit.
Yeah, absolutely. I appreciate you letting me on here, and it's money well spent. I greatly appreciate the podcast.
And do you have any, like, do me a favor, introduce yourself and tell us why you're here.
I stumbled across the podcast a while back searching for podcasts through a podcast app. I was looking for anything that had anything to do with the registry. And you being the genius you are, you put registry in the name of your podcast. So I found it and I started listening to it. And I quickly realized it was the only platform that was, I would say, done correctly, and it had good content, and it wasn't a bunch of people yelling and hollering and screaming and giving off a bunch of foul opinions. It was the law, and it was given, you know, I was getting good information, and I thought, this is something that I need to support, because it was the only thing I had seen or even found that was being done this way, and you can understand it. And thankfully for us, Larry's on this podcast, and you can ask the question, and Larry can usually bring it on home with an answer that, you know, your average person can understand most of the time. And I seen the value in this, and I thought, this is something that, you know, it's absolutely worth supporting. I think one of the first things I did was reach out to you and see if you needed any equipment, thinking maybe you were somebody that didn't have anything or didn't have enough to do the show, not knowing that you're the IT guy that you are, but everything that you have. So I just really wanted to support it and try to do the little bit I could to make sure that the show, you know, kept going. Because honestly, one of my biggest concerns is that it wouldn't continue. The content was so good. It was exactly the things that I was trying to find. And, you know, if you don't pull this stuff together, it's all over the place. And it's nice to be able to go to one place to find a lot of this.
Well, now that my ego, I won't be able to walk through the door because my head will be so big. Larry, chime in anytime you want to.
Well, that explains where all of our money has gone. You paid this guy, this imposter, to come on here.
Yes, that's where all of my money, that's why I'm living in a tiny little shack, is because I hired Mike to come on and give us all that praise.
Well, you know, that's not the case in this situation, but that does happen out there. People do,
of course it does,
pay for promotions. And they pay handsome money for it, but we're not doing that. We don't have the money, first of all, and it wouldn't be honest to do that.
You're not independently wealthy like that, Larry, to just drop all the monies?
I don't think so. At least, no, I'm not.
Yeah. Well, let me expand on this just a little bit, just to kind of give you a little more history of, you know, where I'm coming from here. I've been on the registry here in the state of Florida since the day, I guess, since it started. I was actually done with my case, released from Florida State Prison and home, and I was done. And then all, you know, the changes came along, and we were retroactive added to it, and you're all aware of it, where it's at now. And I've been on it for, I guess it's been in Florida about 23 years, something like that. And my case is close to pushing 30 years old, something like that. And so I've seen the progression from where it came when it was originally very benign and it really wasn't that big of a deal. It stunk, but it really became a problem when it became public. And then after, you know, when SORNA and the Adam Walsh Act and all the things that kept adding to it, it just got worse and worse and worse. And so I've seen the changes over the years and how bad it's gotten. So I started, you know, trying to branch out and find, you know, you really just can't find this kind of information anywhere. It's kind of hard to find where people aren't spewing hate speech. I don't use social media. I don't really prefer it. I much rather listen to this. And so, you know, with all these years that I've been on this thing, I've seen it all. I've had people, you know, I've had the nonsense done to my house, my cars. I've had my kids harassed. Pretty much anything you can think of, I've already done it other than being shot at or anything crazy like that. But my concern this far into it, now that I'm getting older, is not so much about me anymore and getting off of it. And I don't even care about talking about innocent or guilt or who did what anymore. I'm to the point where I'd like to see something done legitimately for the young people, because the young people that I'm looking around that are, you know, my nieces and nephews and kids coming up in school, you know, what they could potentially step into is a nightmare. And to just sit around and not at least try to warn some people. I have told tons of family members, church members, I've sat them down, the ones that'll listen. And I mean, 10 or 15 people, 20 people at a time, and said, listen, this is how easy it is for your child to end up on this registry. This is no joke. And I explained to them, and you would be surprised. You guys wouldn't be surprised, but a majority of them say, there's no way that's not possible. If the kid is this age and that age, the law won't do anything once you explain it to them. And I told them, you know, what you guys already know, that's absolute insanity. You absolutely will end up in a mess. And if you don't warn your kids and teach them what they can and can't do, they could easily turn around and find themselves in a mess. And this registry is no joke, especially down here in Florida. And God forbid if you live in Broward County. So, you know, I haven't done anything publicly.
End up with crazy lobbyists that are drunk drivers.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, that's a mess down there. And I'm a little chatty, so if you need to slow me down, by all means, go ahead. But one of the things that I wanted to say, if 50 people listen to this, or when this thing blows up here in a few months and you've got, you know, 10 or 20,000 downloads a week, if anybody goes back and listens to this and you're fresh out of jail, or you're coming home, or you've just been convicted, whatever your situation may be, I realize from my experiences, they can be extraordinarily hard. And at times, a lot of people that I've run into, even just at the registry place, they think that they're alone. They think that they don't have anybody to support them. They think there's nowhere to find information. They think no one's in their corner. And while I don't obviously condone any kind of sex crime, I also don't condone treating people the way the registry treats people. People need help. They don't need to be, you know, pretty much buried in legal issues and things like that. And I just think it's really important for anybody that hears this to know that there's people that care about them. I had no idea. You can't imagine how good I felt when I found out about NARSL. I had no idea NARSL existed. When I started reading what NARSL was doing, it really like made my year. Then I found Florida Action Committee, and then I started seeing people like, I think it's, is it Mary DeVoy or DeVore? I don't know how you pronounce your name. The lady's up in Virginia.
Mary Davie DeVoy?
Yes, that's it. I started seeing these people, you know, throughout the country who were doing things, and I started reading about it, and it was very encouraging to see that people understood, and they felt like I do. You know, they're like, they don't want people out there hurting anyone, and they don't want a true predator out on the, you know, on the loose hurting people. But this registry hurts a lot of people, hurts a lot of families, and it causes a lot of unnecessary grief, and it goes on and on. And you guys are very familiar with that. But that's really why I reached out. I've tried to put money into the program. That's why I wanted to, you know, eventually to talk to you guys like I'm doing now. But for any registrant that gets on here, I mean, I really think all of them should be listening to this in some, any way they can get to it. And it's, to me, it's just that important. They need to know. They need to know the laws. They need to know what they're up against, because not knowing it can really cause you a lot of grief. And I shared a story with Andy the other day about being let off the registry. Being let off probation, and I was done. I signed some papers and went home. A couple of years down the road, my home was broken into. So I picked up the phone, called the police department, said, "Hey, someone broke into my home." They came out and filed a police report, said, "Okay, have a nice day." They come back a couple of days later and arrested me for failing to register. They said I had moved and not had changed my address for so many hours. And at that time, I had no idea it was even a law. So not knowing really put me in a bind, and it was probably 16 years ago. Right. So just by making a simple mistake like that, it cost me a lot. So, you know, these people, especially registrants, they really need to know the laws. And this is just a great place to find that and hear about it and all the things that are going on. And I just can't say enough of good stuff about you guys, and the chemistry you have on here is great. I love how you're always picking on Larry, and you know, he takes it well. So anyway, that's right. Really why I'm here, you know.
Larry, before we get diving into the whole show, though, I did have a question that I wanted to ask you, and you prompted something, and I wanted to get a further expansion on it. I guess it would be even like the misnomer when people say they want justice. And I wanted to hear from your side of things what you would consider to be the definition of justice and how we could contrast that against what the general public thinks about the term justice.
Sure, I'd like to respond to one point that Mike made before it becomes ancient history here. The what he pointed out about the registry, his words were to the effect that it was relatively simple and easy in the beginning, which was the first generation registry when the push was on in the 90s when the Jacob Wetterling Act passed. The registers were fairly benign compared to the first generation. Were fairly benign. People could have, in many cases, just mailed in a form, and not in all cases, but in many states, that was all there was to it. And what happened was that first generation registry was what went up to the U.S. Supreme Court in 2003, and the infamous Smith versus Doe out of Alaska, where that there was very little required of a registrant other than mailing in a form. Well, after that affirmation by the Supreme Court saying that that was not something that violated the ex post facto clause, it was so benign. What happened illustrates the point of this podcast. We had people representing various states coming into the legislature saying, as they proposed these add-ons and these enhancements, they would be lawmakers, and I witnessed it myself, say, "Well, can we do that? Isn't that punishment?" And they would say, "No, ma'am, no, sir. The Supreme Court said we can do that." And we weren't there. Our side wasn't there in 2000, in the early 2000s, to give testimony and to respond. So the state's representatives and advocates, the law enforcement apparatus said, "Yes, we can. The Supreme Court said so. It's okay." And we weren't there to say, "Well, no, actually, the Supreme Court did not say that. What the Supreme Court actually did say was that you can do that relatively benign version of registration, which is what Alaska had. And they said you can do it because it doesn't." And it went through a litany of things that you're not allowed to do to have a regulatory scheme. But we weren't there. So
when you say we, you're talking about our advocacy side. You're not talking about political spectrums, right?
I'm talking about people who would be impacted adversely by the registry requirements. They were at home drinking their tequila, thinking that everything was fine, and they were going to hide under the rock and hope to ride out, because most of the registries start out as a 10-year requirement. And they were hoping they were going to sail off into the sunset after 10 years and be done with it by mailing in their forms. And it never occurred to them that the laws can actually change, and they do change on a regular basis. So the absence from the scene is what led to all these laws being enhanced, because the registry community wasn't there, but the law enforcement and the victims' advocates were. So we get into that more when we start talking about the legislative process. But that's what I thought was worth mentioning.
Yeah, and then on the heels of all that, a person on Twitter posted a whole bunch of bills going through various states a Texas lawmaker introduces House bill prohibiting incarcerated sex offenders from soliciting pen pals. Massachusetts lawmaker introduces bill to deny certain convicted sex offenders access to state subsidized public housing facilities. And there were like four or five bills that that guy posted that are just ridiculously silly, just continuing to extend out all the stuff. And our side generally doesn't step up to the plate to try and represent our side to push back on this at all. We just lose by default.
Absolutely. It's maybe I'll tell the towing bill story from my state at some point, but the tow company wasn't there. The tow operators weren't there, and they almost got screwed except for intervention in the final moments of when a bill would have been passed and sent to the governor. There was some intervention, but if you're not there, these people are dealing with hundreds and hundreds of pieces of legislation, and they're operating and high volume intensity, and they're hearing from people who are supposed to be advocates are coming in favor of the bills, and the doors are open for you to come speak against the bills when they're in committees. And if you don't come tell them the problems, don't assume they're magically going to be discovered.
Right. Yeah. So just, make sure you don't show up, and that way you can forever bitch about what things have happened to you because you
were there. All right. So your question about what is justice?
Yeah, tell me about justice. And I think there's three sides of it, isn't there? Maybe more.
Well, when we hear that term, that I want to see justice done, what people I think on average are thinking that they want to see a person held accountable for their actions, and they want to see usually punishment. This country we're big on punishment. There's models of justice that are reconciliation but ours here is heavily weighted in punishment. But I don't think of justice as just being punishment. I think of justice as a broader definition of justice. And I look at how we have what's supposed to be an orderly administration of justice. And justice is to make sure that there's no vigilante action, and that the process is fair to both parties. And the victims' advocates have convinced the lawmakers that we should be the primary consideration in the orderly administration of justice. You should make sure that we're cared for. But the people who would be put away for decades in some cases, or for life without parole, or even sent to the execution chambers, they get lost in this debate. The process is supposed to be fair to them because of the enormous power that the state has and the resources that the state has. It's incumbent upon the possessor of that power to make sure that the people who lack that power are treated fairly. Someone has to say, Andy can't get a fair trial if we bring charges against him 47 years after something happened. And we have to be able to look at that accuser and say, you wouldn't want that, would you? You wouldn't want a person to face the enormous power of the state and not be able to get a fair trial and face the rest of their life in prison, would you? And some would say yes, but most people would not say yes. And so I think justice is the responsibility of collectively of society to make sure that the process is fair to everyone. And that doesn't mean mollycoddling. That means making sure that there's adequate legal representation, that the rules are followed, and that everything that's done to continue that presumption of innocence, and make sure we don't shackle people when we bring them in courtrooms to contaminate the jury, to make the jury believe. I mean, when you bring a person shackled and chained and they got leg irons and waist irons and all this stuff in the prison and they can barely move a few inches, what do you think the jury would think about that? About
they
that
individual? Obviously think that it's a bad, terrible, horrible monster.
So I would like to see a judge sitting on a bench and say, Mr. Sheriff, you will not bring people into my courtroom like that when there's a jury present. It's my job, in order to see that justice is done, that this person gets a fair trial, and they can't get a fair trial if you're going to contaminate this jury with all that charade that you just did.
But doesn't
the poor guy, the guy with the shackles, the can't do that. Elected.
Right, but the judge is also elected, and he has to answer through the next election cycle to the citizen saying, we want vigilante justice. Not that they're saying that, but they push back, and they want that, right?
They do. And I'm sensitive to the political reality. Judges. That's why the U.S. System at the federal level is under the Constitution, under Article 3, where we have lifetime tenure, and judges are supposed to be as far removed from that process as you can. I mean, they're not totally removed because they're appointed by the political party in charge at the time that the vacancies arise. But you insulate to some degree after the initial political decisions made in terms of who's going to get the appointment. But
I don't want to go on a huge tangent, but now people are talking about putting in term limits for the Supreme Court.
I don't see that happening.
No, but I got to think that, you know, just like what you described as there being, you're removed from the political process. Obviously, you're appointed by the president. So that aligns you sort of party-ish, but still they have to get confirmed. Generally, the Senate should be roughly balanced, whatever. They have to go through that confirmation process. Anywho, my point with the three sides, though, is that so you have a victim and they want justice. You have an accused who may or may not actually be the one that committed the crime. And then you have the person that effectively did the crime. And then you have the judicial system. Those were the three legs. And I kind of threw an extra one in there with the person that actually committed the crime in there, too.
Well, justice is something that we should strive for as close to perfection as we can. I mean, we're not going to have perfection in anything humans do. But when we're putting people in a cage, and I use this over and over on the podcast, American cages are not the best cages to be in.
No, they're not fun.
And so when we're talking about putting an individual in a cage for a long period of time, we need, if there's a benefit of the doubt, it has to continue to go with the person who's going to potentially be caged. I'm sorry, but that's the way it has to be. The person who is alleging they were a victim of a crime, they're not going to be facing the lifetime of being in a cage. Now, they may be carrying scars from what happened to them and emotional trauma. It may be even physical trauma, depending on what the type of the crime was. But I'm not diminishing that. But yeah, we have to make sure that the person that gets put in the cage is the person who did it, is responsible. And we have a greater calling as society to make sure we get this right. And I think we're failing miserably in that. I think we're seeing too many exonerations, and we see prosecutors fight relentlessly to prevent testing of old cases using forensics techniques that have evolved. We see, which we'll talk about later in this podcast, we see them trying to preserve convictions that should never have occurred. It's amazing.
Well, yeah, before we run this thing into the ground of just talking about this in circles, a listener wrote in via the website. This is kind of a funny question, but I've considered this. So would it be possible to rent rooms and reside in enough states that would make it possible to physically get to each state's registration office and register before penalties would be imposed? Would that show it's restrictive enough to be unconstitutional? Seems to be what he's describing is, could you move from state to state to state to state to state to state to state and just keep moving about and never actually land anywhere and never have to register?
That's what he's meaning by that question. I wasn't sure what the question was.
To me, that's what it means, but
I mean, if you had gobs of money and you could do that, you would probably want to take off the states that have like 48-hour windows to register.
Correct.
But the states that have slightly longer windows, if you had gobs of money, could do that. Would be a viable theory. But once a person was nutty enough, and trust me, there are nutty people out there on the registry, they will go tell the sheriff, "I'm doing this to avoid registration." people come to our state and they, "Well, why did you come to New Mexico?" "Well, you know, the laws are pretty tough down in Florida. And we got to looking at your laws, and they're not too bad." Well, guess what they do? They write that up, they take note of that, they document that, and they bring that to Santa Fe. And they say, "In the last year, we've had 79 people locate here from other states. And of the 79, 64 of them have told us they moved here because our laws are more lax." Now, do you think that that inspires New Mexico legislators to relax their laws? Or do you think it would inspire New Mexico legislators to make their laws tougher? Which do you think would be the likely outcome of that?
I'm pretty sure it would be B.
Well, pretty sure. My point was that somebody was doing that. If someone had the money to do that, they would inevitably blab their mouth and say, "Well, I found myself a nice way not to have to register."
So, you know, that makes me think about, oh God, I can't think of the mob boss guy that just got He was just found maybe in the last 2 years. He was up in Boston, whatever. I can't think of the guy's name. But he stayed on the lam for, what, 40 years or something like that? He just kept a really low profile. He even got married, but he just stayed low, and someone recognized him when, you know, he went to the grocery store or whatever. So just keep your freaking head down and don't draw attention to yourself. And, like, hey, don't go down to the sheriff's office and say, hey, I'm here just to give you the big fat F you and bring attention to everyone else.
So, yeah, if that's what he meant, but I wasn't clear on the question myself.
All right. Well, then Will in Tennessee, who always sends us some voicemail message, and he also just saying, if you don't put FYP at the end of your messages, it is possible that they don't get played. Just saying.
All righty.
Good evening. This is William from Tennessee, and I'm currently listening to RM69 and... one of your call-ins asked a question about interstate compacts, and it brought a question to my mind. There's a nearby state that does not have lifetime supervision with supervision to a state that doesn't have that law. How does that affect your supervision, and what rules do you still have to follow the rules from your receiving state once you get to the new jurisdiction? Thank you. Keep up the good work, and... have a great evening.
I just love Will's question so much because he must be a legal beagle of some type because that is really a good question. And the answer is when you have a term of probation or any type of supervision that has reporting as a component of it, reporting any type of reporting requirements. As far as the Interstate Compact for Adult Offender Supervision is concerned, the only probation, parole, or supervision that's not eligible is that that doesn't carry any reporting requirements, which means the judge has to tell you, your fine is $100, you're on unsupervised probation, go away, have a great life. That doesn't trigger the compact. They could give you 10 years of unsupervised probation with those conditions, and you wouldn't have to be transferred. But if you have any reporting requirements, and to my knowledge, every state that has community supervision for life, that's not unsupervised. That's why they call it community supervision for life, which means that you are reporting. So that is transferable under the interstate compact. And since we've covered previously that the duration of supervision is established by the sending state, that lifetime goes with you. Now he's intelligent enough to figure out that states that don't have that don't appreciate being saddled with a responsibility to supervise a 25-year-old for the next 50 or 60 years. And that was raised in the interstate compact by states who were getting stuck with these New Jersey and out-of-state offenders that were moving. And when they got their packet, they're, oh, I got to supervise this person for life. What the hell's going on here? We don't do that here. And they asked for the Interstate Compact Commission to give an advisory opinion as to whether they were obligated to take those cases because they didn't want those cases. A, they're high profile because they're sexual offenses, and B, they never end. And the Compact Commission, which is made up of delegates from the states, they issued an advisory opinion a number of years ago, probably close to 10 years ago, that those cases are in fact transferable and you're obligated to supervise them for the duration of their supervision until they're relieved of that burden in the by the sending state. So yes, if you transfer your New Jersey supervision for life to Georgia, Georgia will keep you on its supervisory rolls until New Jersey cuts you loose, and they're obligated to do that.
So you can't move to get out from underneath the problem?
Nope, you can't do that. So if you're on supervision for life in Tennessee, and you transfer your probation to California, you're going to be on supervision for life in California. Now, you are dealing with human beings, and you are dealing with realities of situations with resources. I can't tell you how aggressively they would supervise you. I think it would probably depend on the individual probation district, how much energy they put in trying to drive offenders back to the state that they came from, or whether they're willing to tolerate them and be lax and less demanding. It could be that after you've been on CSL for a number of years, even though it technically lasts for a lifetime, it could be that your supervision could get pretty easy. But I wouldn't bank on that happening.
Right. All right, then. Well, Mike is joining us to further elaborate on the question that he had last week about the legislative process. And then I think Mike went back, and after your answer, Larry, which probably made most people's heads spin because it was like long and involved and detailed, and Mike said that he did some research. He was like, oh my God, I thought this was pretty easy. So, Mike, you're here to try and hone in and get a little bit more detailed information about the legislative process.
Yeah, absolutely. After I realized after hearing Larry's answer last week that it was a very involved question, and what I was asking was asking a lot of Larry to answer something like that and dumb it down. And after I did my research, I realized that I don't know anything about how our laws are created and passed through Senate and the House. So in one way, it was good. It's pushing me to educate myself, and you can't go wrong there. So in lieu of asking a big, broad question this week, I had a couple of specific things that I wanted to ask. And I know that each state is different, so maybe you'll be able to answer it and maybe not. But one of the things I noticed is when the bill is pushed through the House and the Senate, and Larry, if I say anything here that's incorrect, please correct me so I don't want to lead anybody else astray. One question that I had that I noticed is that with the committees, they had a couple of different kinds. They had a standing committee and a subcommittee, and they had special committees. My question is, what are the differences between those, and are the same senators who introduce these laws allowed to sit on the committees that oversee these and look at them once they're submitted to those committees? So in other words, if they submit a bill, and I realize down here it's a Republican stronghold right now, are they allowed to submit it and be on a committee to where they can kind of sway it their way? Is that what I'm understanding?
You're absolutely, that is correct. That's a great question. You very well, a lawmaker that introduces a piece of legislation is not forbidden to sit on a committee. That would really hamper their work. So if they introduce, if they sit on a judiciary committee, they introduce something with criminal justice, which almost always makes its way to a judiciary committee or something of a similar name in each state. If that member happens to sit on judiciary committee, they take part in the discussions, they present their bill, and they vote. They get to vote to advance that bill. There's no need for them to recuse themselves. They were elected by the people of that particular district, and they're equally a part of that process. They normally go present their bill. They would be sitting down at the committee table when that bill is called, rather than being sitting in the committee position. If you look at a committee hearing, they're usually in some type of horseshoe or some type of arrangement where they're looking at the presenter and the sponsor. The sponsor, if he or she happens to sit on that committee, they would go sitting at the witness table, but they would still be able to vote when the bill comes up for a vote.
That's eye opening. Now I'm starting to understand why these guys fight for control so much. And I really had no idea it worked that way. And that's kind of what I gathered from it. It's just amazing that you can introduce a bill, get sent to a committee that you're part of, and you can approve it, and it's, slides through. And then, and if no one opposes it, I guess it just becomes law.
Well, it gets it to the, it gets it to the floor. The committee, okay. Like in the case of the bill that we looked at in show prep, it's got multiple steps. So it gets it through the first committee. But it has to go through all those committees, and then it has to go to the floor for the full body. And the overwhelming majority of the time, when something makes it through the committee process, it's going to be voted in favor on the floor, because that's the way the system is designed, to take the recommendation of the people who have more specialized knowledge in those committees. So if it's gone through two committees in the House of Representatives, or maybe in the case of the bill we looked at, it looks like it's got a couple subcommittees and two committees. If it's gone through all that vetting, the membership tends to defer to them because there's not enough time to hear every single bill in its totality and debate it from every angle on the floor. You would never get through the session. So those bills come with a lot of respect for the committee process, and they're likely going to be voted for final approval on the floor if they make it to the floor. The battle is in the committee. If you're opposed to something, the battle is to keep it in committee. If you're in favor of something, the battle is to get it out of committee and to the floor.
Something that you bring up a lot, Larry, though, is you're not necessarily in favor of going and quote unquote testifying. You try and influence things before that while it's in committees and derail or support things on that side.
It's a personal preference. I don't necessarily advise people because they're going to start out without the relationships that I have and without the as deep of understanding of the process. And it's like the horse, if you don't know how to ride it, it gets irritated. If you go in and try to do what I do, you don't understand the process and you're not sympathetic to the politics. I can tell any member I talk to what the politics of their constituency is going to be like and how I can help them with some talking points to their constituents of their particular part of the state will relate to. And so therefore, I tend to prefer private meetings because you can talk more freely. You can tell them you're full of itche if you need to. You can tell them that they're grandstanding if you need to. You can't do that in a public setting. But in order to get these private meetings, you have to have relationships and they have to trust and respect you. I have a little more easy access in a small state and having been around the building for as long as I have to have that access. So just because I do it that way, I wouldn't be sitting here saying that's the thing to do because it would be asking people to do what would be almost impossible as a beginner. As a beginner, you're probably going to be relegated to going to the committees, waiting in the hot room through a list of bills to be called and wait for your chance to have your 1, 2, or 3 minutes say, and possibly turn in a handout to the committee. That's probably where you're going to start at. But my okay. personal preference is that I've moved past that through training and experience. I've moved past that. That I don't like to sit in the hot room for 3 hours and wait for my bill to be called. If I can get all the people that I need to get the information to the key people, and I don't have to sit in the hot room, why would you want to do that?
Yeah, that's reasonable. Mike, what other questions did you have?
I think that was basically the biggest one I had that I didn't understand. I don't want to, you know, spend too much time on that because I realized it. We could go. Larry could probably go all day on this. And, I appreciate the answer, and I do understand what you're saying. But yeah, I mean, that was really just what I'm hoping will happen. Just kind of on a little rabbit trail, I'm hoping that people in every state will start to hear this and the topics and the discussion on this podcast. And I'm hoping they'll do what I do. There's a lot of intelligent people in the registry. There's some people that have means. I do pretty well. I have a great support system. I have a good job. My wife has a fantastic income, and I've worked my backside off for, you know, my entire life to have what I have. So we have some resources, and I would just like to hear and start seeing people call in and start putting their money where their mouth is. You can't sit home and whine like a baby about all these issues. Unfortunately, in the state of Florida, I can't vote. So
yeah,
I can't vote, but I can spend my money however I want to. And yep. I can support these causes financially, and I'm absolutely intend on doing that. And I have done some, but I would hope a lot of other people would start hearing this and start educating themselves, start learning the laws in their state, start figuring out how these laws are made. Because I'm an expert.
It also
in something,
doesn't just apply to us. It also doesn't just apply to this, as Larry just mentioned a minute ago about the tow truck issue. If you if you want streetlights, if you want zoning changed, if you want your school system changed, all that stuff is available to you, even though you, me, we can't vote. And, you know, depending on the state, I think it's 26 where we do get our voting rights back. It just this applies. We just happen to be targeting in this one area where everyone hates us.
Right. Well, Larry made a statement a couple weeks ago. I believe it was Larry. It had a huge impact on me. I believe it was Larry. Correct me if I'm wrong here. He said that. I've heard so many people, Larry said that politics and impact just about every area of your life, whether or not yes. you like those guys sitting on TV, arguing back and forth and throwing mud at each other, that's not necessarily politics. And it kind of set a light bulb off. I said, you know, he's absolutely right. I had no idea. I never really took the time to realize how much it affects everything we do. I mean, live from the roads we drive on to the schools our kids go to. And, It really helped me out quite a bit. It got me thinking, and I would just, you know, my hope is that people will hear this and start doing some thinking for themselves instead of sitting at the house whining about it. Because I can tell you this, I probably spent the first 10 or 15 years of being on the registry when it really came into effect, just having a pity party And then one day I said, you know, this isn't going to work. They don't care. I'm not helping anybody by whining about it. Let me see what I can do about it. And that's when I started searching out, you know, for information. And that's kind of when I stumbled across you guys. So, you know, that's really my hope, that would people would just start using their heads and their resources to make things happen.
Well, let's do a little more civics lesson here before we get off this. And just to compare the two, because like, for example, Florida has 21 billion people. My state has 2 million. So you have 10 times the population. Well, in Florida, each representative represents 182,000 roughly. And each senator, since you only have 40 senators, represents 540,000 residents, which is almost as the number, same number as a member of the U.S. Congress, because there's 435 members of the United States House. They're representing over 500,000 people each. Well, Florida senators representing over 500,000 Floridians. You're not going to have as easy access as I do, because it's a much bigger operation in Florida with that many people. So there's going to be layers of people you'll go through, and you'll have to really work hard to get relationships with the lawmakers that I enjoy in a small state. But it can be done. And when you say you're a person of means, that gives you the advantage, because politics, the lifeblood of politics is money. It takes money to get elected. When you're having to run in media markets as big as the media markets are in Florida, when you're running in Jacksonville, Tampa, and Miami, and Orlando, and places where it costs gobs of money to advertise, they need gobs of money to get elected. And so that you have a gateway that the average person that's picking up litter for a living doesn't have. Because you can make a campaign donation of a reasonable size, and miraculously, you'll find yourself with a lot of access.
Larry, are you saying that our government is the best government that money can buy?
I don't know if I'm saying that, but I'm saying the reality of the situation is that until we have public financing, which Americans are dead set against, that the way you get an office so you can – those who have a calling to do good things, because I know that some people believe that everybody who runs for office wants to do bad things. But those who have a calling to do good things and serve the community and make life better, they need to run. And most of them are not independently wealthy. So these races for state house and state senate in Florida, where you might spend $100,000 for a house race in New Mexico, you'd spend 10 times that in Florida, easily 5 to 10 times that, because of the expense of running a campaign in a state like that. And where do you think a person who has limited means is going to get $300,000-$500,000 to run a campaign? Well, they get it not from the people who work at McDonald's. They get it from people who have much greater financial resources, and those are the people who get more direct access to the person, because money is what it takes to be in that position. So
funny that
you have,
said,
even though you're not a voter, you have power that a lot of people don't have.
The statement about public financing. So our first article is exonerated man who spent years in prison in New York calls for public financing of elections. This is from the New York Law Journal. This is a man that spent he spent 22 years in prison, and he petitioned to try and get DNA evidence released and tested a bazillion times. And he eventually got it awarded and was released because of they finally did a DNA test. And it was sitting there, but they kept saying it was lost.
Oh, what's your problem with that?
If we go back to the justice conversation, I mean, this man spent 22 years away from family, away from existing in the world as we know it, because it feels like it would be like the DA saying, we don't want this guy's DNA tested because we know he's innocent and it'll make us look bad. And we don't hold we cover articles on prosecutorial misconduct. And this, to me, feels something along those lines. Justice isn't served.
We gripe about that all the time. I gripe about what is clearly in the rules of professional conduct. A prosecutor has a higher ethical duty to see to it that justice is done, which goes back on what I said at the beginning of the podcast. Justice doesn't just mean a conviction. justice means to make sure we've got the right person. A prosecutor is not supposed to have they're not supposed to want an innocent person to be convicted. And
the
they should be.
Seems to incentivize them to be looking for convictions. That seems to be what their incentive structure is, and not in some sort of justice of actual justice. I don't know how you measure that, but they are just measuring based on convictions. And by golly, I was tough on crime and I locked up X number more people than my previous guy did. And this guy's soft on crime. Therefore you should vote for me.
That does tend to be way worse than the political process. Does that raise the question? Maybe prosecutors should not be elected directly by the people. Could we possibly have that discussion someday in this country that's not the best model?
Can you expand on that? I haven't heard of that thrown before.
Well, I'm just raising that question.
Could
this mean that perhaps, I know America does everything greater than anybody other country, but I always believe that we can try to improve from here, even though we are the greatest. And I do believe we are great. I don't believe we're the greatest in all aspects, but I believe America has a lot of things great. But I believe that this is something where we might ought to take a look at if people do have, as a prosecutor, a higher ethical, moral obligation to do the right thing. Perhaps maybe we should remove from the equation the mob mentality of just lock them up, throw away the key, because that's the pressure they're under from the voters. Like I say, try going out and campaigning, except in Philadelphia. Try going out in an average city, in particular in suburban America, and campaigning on the platform. We want to divert as many people as we can from prison. We want to scrutinize the police charges as carefully as we can because we know the police are overzealous and they wanted to build their file. And try campaigning on that and tell me how that works out when you run for DA.
Yeah.
So it might be time for us to rethink how we place people in the prosecutorial roles. Maybe the elections is not possibly the best answer. At the federal system, not saying that's an ideal solution either, because we've polluted that with minimum sentences and the criminal justice, the Sentencing Reform Act of 1984. But the federal U.S. attorneys are appointed by the president, which are effectively appointed by the senators from the state. But that's an appointed position. You can't vote for a U.S. attorney.
All right. But we do it at the state level all day long.
We do it in almost all states. I'm not familiar with very many states where the people who prosecute are not elected.
Yeah, interesting.
I think I might have heard of it in Massachusetts or somewhere in the Northeast, but they're elected broadly across the country.
So it took me, since I'm stupid, it took me a minute to figure out that the FBI director is like done for 10 years, and that way it's pretty far removed from the political process of appointing who that person is. So build a model of something like that.
Well, or is it that didn't we just see an FBI director removed under this administration?
I'm not trying to go there. I was just saying that I know that they're appointed.
But you said it was removed.
Of...
Yeah, they are. That was the idea. That was actually the idea. Yeah. That was after J. Edgar Hoover died, and I believe he died in 73. When Hoover died in 73, after having somebody in there for 40 years as director, that was a way to make sure we didn't have another dynasty, but also to try to insulate the office from extreme political influences of having a 10-year appointment. But then what I thought was impossible, I'd had in the back of my mind before this administration removed the FBI director, I thought that they could not be removed except for some extraordinary malfeasance.
Of course.
You know, there was a much more elaborate process. So I'm not sure that is sufficient, but it's a step in the right direction.
Right. Well, and then you just brought up Krasner, the Philly DA, and this article's from The Enquirer. It says, Philly DA Larry Krasner, we took on mass incarceration. Now we're addressing mass supervision. I hadn't even considered this when we've covered this guy in the past. So now he's talking about having extreme limitations. They've already had massive reductions in the prison population for Philadelphia, and now they're going to try and reduce the supervision restriction, requirements from, I think it's like maximum of 2 years of supervision, but things like 3 and 6 month long supervision terms.
We can't have that. All that you must be a flaming.
It's all this lefty mumbo jumbo, right?
I mean, we're going to have a crime wave that you've never imagined, and that place is going to be run over with hooligans and thugs.
Hooligans, huh? That's a word that you don't hear very often.
Well, I like that word.
42,000 people are on county supervision as of the end of 2017, or 1 in 22 adults. Statewide, Philadelphians are under correctional control at the second highest rate, behind which state, Larry?
I don't know which state.
Georgia. I think it's 1 in 9 here are on some kind of supervision. It's a ridiculous number.
You people privatized a lot of your probation supervision there, so that's a perverse incentive to build the probation caseloads.
Again, like, listen to the podcast Freakonomics, because they just talk about the incentives, not just necessarily from an economic point of view, but they just talk about incentives in general and how you can motivate people to do different things and what are their motivations to do things. It's pretty stellar. And this, again, would be when you privatize something like this, when you privatize dealing with humans, the incentives are all whacked out. It's just things are going to go south in a bad, bad way.
So, I consider your that kind of comment about the privates, that's blasphemy. Everybody knows that the private sector does everything and anything better than the government sector, and that everything that could possibly be privatized should be. And everybody knows that. I don't even know why we're wasting time on this podcast.
Okay, so we'll stop. We'll shut it all down right now. That's it. We're over. Click stop on the record. And
but you know,
it.
The funny thing is, when people say that, I always say, well, okay, you say that, but I don't think that I've found anybody who likes private prisons better. I found one or two that said simply because they were air conditioned, but not from a programmatic point of view, not from professionalism or their staffing, but because in some of the states that are notoriously like Texas and Florida, where they don't air condition their facilities, they said that the private ones were built according to their standards, and they were air conditioned. But I've not heard of anyone say from a programmatic point of view that they preferred a private prison. I'm waiting for it, but I haven't heard of it yet.
Well, I will speak to my own personal experience that the food was better at the private one than the state one.
And I've heard canteens are better in the private. They have a wider variety of things on the commissary.
Because they have an economic incentive to do more shit. That's why
I can
that's
testify to the ones in Florida not being air conditioned. That is true.
Oh my God! Which, and the humidity. Oh my God, dude. Seriously.
Which are not air conditioned? All of them, or the private ones? Air conditioned?
I was only in a couple of the public ones or the state operated ones, and they were. Right. I think they had the extra heat on, because I'm telling you, it was hot.
Well, that's been a beef of ours on the podcast. If you're a long-term listener, I can't imagine that we cook people that way. Knowing the ill health effects of what it does to the people. Period. I mean, the inmates as well as the staff having them in that kind of environment. But the staff at least get to go home after 7, 8, 9 hours.
Well, the staff had air-conditioned offices that overlooked the dormitories, so they weren't suffering that much. And to something that Larry says many, I've heard Larry say many times. At that time, I was a young man and in fantastic shape, and it's a lot harder on older people. You know, extremely harder on older people. Those kind of conditions are hard. You know, so.
Well, I'm glad to hear you affirm that, because. But I try to have that discussion with people when they talk about sentencing options. And I say, well, we need to calculate the age of the person being sentenced, because it's relation. If you're merely wanting to extract punishment, which it seems like that's where your head is, then when you give someone like Paul Manafort 7 years as a 70-year-old, 7 years on a 70-year-old is going to be way tougher than 7 years on a 20-year-old, if the 20-year-old is in average to decent health. And so you're getting your suffering by 7 years, although you'd like it to be 70 for people who want him to never come out of prison again. But 7 years on a 70-year-old guy is pretty tough punishment.
I would agree.
Well, and then moving on to the New York Times, he spent 36 years behind bars. A fingerprint database cleared him in hours. Like, I'm right on the heels of the first article we covered. Here's a guy that spent a freaking long time. Oh, my God. He spent almost 4 decades in prison. Got locked up in 1982. The thing that drives me crazy, and we talk about this, and this goes to the whole justice thing, is that the woman said that she just adamantly remembered the guy that was locked up for 40 years. She just knew that was him. That was his face. And perhaps she saw him somewhere during the day, but I think even during the trial, they said, well, you know, even though the fingerprints don't match, but the victim picked him out in a lineup and identified him as her rapist in court. It just seems unconscionable to me that we would lock somebody up for 40 years.
Well, it seems like to me, I read in here that the prosecutor acknowledged in closing arguments that the fingerprints didn't match, but he said her memory did. Yeah, he acknowledged it. Well, fingerprints don't match, but she remembers, and we should always trust the victim's memory. No, we actually shouldn't always trust the victim's memory, but everyone's afraid to say that.
And we should call up King to get some sort of statement on this one. But if I recall right, so he's suing the state, and there's a law that says he can only get, under Louisiana law, Mr. Williams is entitled to a maximum of $250,000 for his wrongful incarceration, the equivalent of around $7,000 for each year that he was in prison.
Well, there you liberals go again. I mean, what do you want to do? Pick the taxpayers' pockets and pay this guy. He had free room and board, medical care for 4 decades, and he didn't have to go out and be competing for a living. And he didn't have all the stress of griping a spouse and kids to be responsible for. I mean, hell, he lived better than many people on the street. I mean, $250,000.
That is true.
What do you want for him? I mean, goodness gracious, you liberals there's never enough for you.
Never enough. And so now, so if he's been in prison for 40 years and he got locked up when he was 20 or whatever, so he's like 60. 250 is probably enough for him to like make ends meet for the rest of his life. But that still is like the wrong question.
Serious folks, disregard everything I said, but $250,000 for your whole life, basically your whole adult life, has been taken from you. All the things you would have done, raising children, traveling, building a career, all that was taken away unjustifiably. $250,000 seems rather pathetic, but the law is the law, and that's what the people wanted. And at the time that they passed that, if you looked at the legislative history of that law, you'd probably see it was passed decades ago. There was no inflation adjustment, any process. Nobody wants to come forward and propose raising that because it means we would have to find money that would be coming away from somewhere else to pay for this kind of stuff. And it's just hard to make a good sell to give people millions of dollars in a one-time payout. I mean, just think about that, going to the assembly and saying, we want there to be an open-ended checkbook for people wrongly incarcerated. I would love to make that argument. I don't think I could win it, but I'd love to make that argument. And I think I'd get a lot of pushback because people would say, my goodness, where are we going to get the money to pay for that? And of course, I'd say, well, then don't lock people up. Make real sure you've got the right people. And make sure that we strive to not lock up the wrong person. We won't be paying these checks very often, would be my answer. But it's going to be a tough sell to raise that $250,000 cap.
Mike, I'm sure you're chomping at the bit to throw something out there.
Yeah, $250,000. I mean, that's a significant amount of money. But if you did maybe 5 or 10 years and you were exonerated and they gave you $250,000, maybe. But I mean, some of that quality free health care that Larry referred to in his statement is, you know, having teeth extracted while you're handcuffed to a dental chair. I don't know that you can put a dollar amount on that, or laying in a sick call with 13 or 14 other people and you have to lay in the floor because you're too sick to stand up and the guards come in and step over you. So, you know, $250,000, that's a little bit of money, but for this man lost his entire life. I mean, I read about that and I was just saddened. That's just horrible because he can't get that time back.
We could throw out there that it's probably fake news because it's from the New York Times.
I listen to the Innocence Project quite a bit, and this is not an uncommon story. The length of his sentence was ridiculous, but it's not uncommon. And it's not uncommon for them to lose the DNA, and it's not uncommon for them to not want to check it. And, you know, prosecutors don't like to give that up, that win up. So I agree with you guys.
And just to circle back, someone in chat said it takes a good prosecutor to convict a guilty man, but it takes a great prosecutor to convict an innocent man. And that was said by prosecutor Douglas D. Mulder out of Dallas, Texas. I don't know when, though, but that's what someone shared.
Oh, I'd have to think about that one.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact them by email, registrymatches@yourtreatmentclass, about the podcast. We want to send out a big heartfelt support for those on the registry. Keep fighting. Without you, we can't succeed. You make it possible.
All right. I totally need every ounce of help that you can give me on this one. I don't know what SSRN stands for, but mens rea reform and its discontents. Something out of the University of Colorado Law School.
Well, we don't have to spend a lot of time on it.
No.
It has been an evolving phenomena of legislative bodies to dispense with a critical and important thing called mens rea. You need to know what you're doing is unlawful, and there has to be a state of mental state of your mind that you, in particular, more important than what I first said, a mental state of an intent to commit a crime. And we play I got you with a statute rather than it being a deliberate. We do a lot with sex offense on the statutory rape type of cases, but we don't just do it on sex offenses. We do it with drug possession. We do it with other things. One of our great race star legends here, the NASCAR Unser, I forget which one, I think it was Bobby, but he was caught in a blizzard. And it was on federal land, and he went into an area that was off limits inadvertently because you couldn't make heads or tails, and they caught him there, and they said, "Well, we don't care. You know, we don't care that you're here, that there was no intent to be here. You're snowmobiling where you're not supposed to be. We can't have that. But I didn't intend to be here. That's too bad. You shouldn't have been." Well, the mens rea is what's being dispensed with. And, the state of Florida, which our guest is from, they did that with drug possession. They did that a number of years ago. They have an affirmative defense. You can allege that they're not yours. My teenager put that in the car. They're not mine. But the burden you get to carry that with the affirmative defense. The reality is you may not know that they're drugs, and you may not know how they got in the vehicle. They could be in your vehicle unbeknownst to you.
Right.
So there's no culpable mental state for you to be in possession of drugs that you're in possession of, but yet under Florida law you can be convicted of that, and that's the dangerous slippery slope we've been headed down. And of course it's good for convictions when the prosecutor in Florida says, "Well, don't tell me your problems. You are a person, right? Yes. You do have possession of this, right? Yes. Well, don't tell me your problems. You're guilty." So.
Is this anything related? I seem to remember Catherine Carpenter talking about strict liability not intermediate scrutiny. Is that similar?
Yes. Well, that's what we did. That was a joint presentation at the Atlanta conference that Catherine and I did.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking about that. And of course, she says that she would like an affirmative defense because strict liability is truly when there is no affirmative defense. It's just you're strictly liable. So there's crimes where an affirmative defense would be an improvement over the status quo. But I don't like an affirmative defense because we have to have them because, like in the case, an affirmative defense means that the issue of the act is no longer relevant. You say I did self-defense. For you to order to assert that defense, you have to admit the underlying activity. Okay. Yeah, I shot the SOB. So that's no longer a question about the dead corpse. The question is whether or not. So you carry the burden in that affirmative defense of showing that your actions were necessary and what a reasonable person would have done in same or similar circumstances. That's one form of an affirmative defense. In the case of a not guilty by insanity, you're not disputing that you did whatever it was, but you're saying that your mental state kept you from being able to conform your conduct to requirements of law. Well, I don't like those defenses, but they're necessary. But I would prefer, in the case of a sexual offense or drug possession, that the prosecutor have to prove that you knew that you had drugs in your possession, that whatever those little blue pills were in fact controlled substances, and that you intended to possess them. And I would prefer that when you get caught having sex with someone who's one day under 16, that they have to prove that you knew that the person was under 16 and that you intended to have sex despite that fact. That would be ideal because then we would have a lot fewer guilty pleas for that offense, because a lot of people are hoodwinked into having sex with someone they think is of the age of consent, come to find that they're not, and they have a strict liability offense. They can't even assert an affirmative defense. And Catherine is saying, hey, well, it'd be better for us to at least have that. Well, it would be better. Real, where they, like in Michigan, they have the mistake of age is no defense. At least having the affirmative defense where you could assert that would be an improvement. But I prefer that actually, it seems like to me that under our system, that's just, that the prosecution should always bear the burden of proving every element beyond a reasonable doubt. And we should never shift any burden to the defense, which is what we're going to talk about later out of a case out of the Ninth Circuit.
Right. Then we are going to move over to the legal intelligencer. I don't think intelligencer is actually a word, but we'll go with it. U.S. Supreme Court considers right to a jury on supervised release. The subheading is the U.S. Supreme Court is currently considering whether a jury, as opposed to a judge, makes certain findings of fact necessary to revoke a defendant's supervised release. You threw this in there kind of late, so I'm going to defer to you on what you have to say.
I like this because we have a number of listeners who are on federal supervised release, which is a component that didn't come about until 1984 with the Sentencing Reform Act that was pushed through in that era of major changes in the federal system. And it's not the same thing, in which the justices were very skeptical, particularly some of the liberals were very skeptical, but even some of the conservatives were skeptical of the government's argument. But it's not the same as parole or probation. When you're on parole, usually that's a part of your sentence. That specific amount of time has been imposed on you. You will be given a sentence of 10 years in some states, and you're eligible for parole after a certain percentage of that has been served. And if you violate, you go back for the remainder up to the remainder of that 10. So therefore, there has been due process afforded you, and you don't get any additional exposure. So the revocation of that parole can be by a less than beyond a reasonable doubt standard, and it can be decided by a judge rather than a jury. When the case of federal supervised release, it doesn't work that way. You serve all of your sentence before you get out, minus the good time deduction, which is somewhere in the 54 day per year range, and then you go into a period of supervised release that can be revoked on the same flimsy, less than the beyond reasonable doubt standard with a relaxed evidentiary standards of the revocation, and by the judge. And the judge can impose more time than what you could have had imposed on you had at the very beginning of when the jury convicted you or you were convicted by your plea. So your sentence ends up being greater than the maximum sentence for that crime. And that's so the Supreme Court is looking at whether or not you should get that before you can have additional time imposed, whether you should get a jury before your supervised release is revoked. And I love it because that's going to change. I
remember we covered something like this recently.
Yes, it's been bobbing around for a while. Yes.
Okay. You could be on probation and you're one day shy of getting off probation. And
well, it's not parole, probation, it's supervised release.
Okay. Sorry. Okay, supervised release, and you're one day or, you know, something like that, and then you have some sort of violation, and the judge says, here, you have 10 years?
They can do
that. Your sentence was supposed to end tomorrow.
They can do that, or they can give you a new period of supervised release, which is expanding the scope of the original jurisdiction of for the crime. And
it's a civil regulatory scheme. It's not punishment.
Well, the government actually argued that.
I've heard that somewhere before. I can't think of where. Oh, wait. Oh, that's right. The registry.
Yeah. The government made a similar argument. If you read that article, it won't open for it. Now it's opening. But yeah, that was in the article. They made that very claim.
That's fascinating.
So this is some for our federal people. We will stay on this. And when the decision comes down by June 1st, we'll talk about it again on the podcast because it's just so fascinating that all of a sudden we could have a new process that would prevent people from serving more time than what the crime actually carried because of the revocation of their supervised release, which follows them. The supervised release is after you've done your time.
Right. You say that as if the opposite could ever be true.
Well, you can get probation and not do any time.
Okay, but you couldn't do probation and then get locked up.
Why couldn't you?
Oh, okay. Well, then, so educate me there. You could?
Well, can't you get locked up while you're on probation?
I guess, but you wouldn't, I mean, for a new charge or for a revocation. Okay, never mind. I gotcha. Never mind. That's just me being stupid again.
So yeah, the supervised release is a concept that I was not really fully understanding back in the 80s. It didn't sound right to me, but as I see it unfold now, I understand more about why people are griping about this, because they can end up, a crime has a 10-year window of punishment, can end up, someone can be punished for much more than that if their supervised release is revoked, and that can be done without a finding of guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. It can be on a technical violation, and I hope that ends. I hope that this comes down the way that
we're trying so hard to remember where I've heard this, because I actually heard like Sonia Sotomayor actually like making, I heard her voice in like the questioning, I think. I can't remember if that's, maybe it was Nina Totenberg or something. Yeah, she was recording
it. Might have been on one of the, because it's been in the news. This is big stuff.
Okay. All right. That's why this is not completely foreign to me. And then before we go through this Ninth Circuit thing, hey, do you remember the governor out of Virginia that has gotten in the news about a month ago for having a kind of controversial photo in a yearbook?
That was... What's his name? Northam.
Yeah. And he proposes unprecedented tweak for a sex offender bill. Mike, you brought up Mary Davy DeVoy not too long ago. And so in this article, this is the governor is saying that fine, you know, sex offenders, maybe we should let them into emergency shelters. And that was Mary Davy DeVoy's, like, she's trying so hard in this last session to get that opened up. And she... ultimately, as far as I know, she quit. She shut down her Twitter account and all that because she couldn't get any traction on this one. And here the governor is saying, yeah, we probably should let them into the shelters during an evacuation event. So go, Governor Northam.
There's your common sense legislation that you talk about sometimes. If it ever was common sense, I think that would be it.
You would think.
I would think.
Larry?
Well, that one's one of those where... I just can't fathom us denying shelter to an individual, whether it be in a natural disaster or inclement weather. I mean, it just right. befuddles my mind in a nation that prides itself on its Christianity and its morality, that we could
forgiveness and all that,
that we could even think of turning someone away for SNAP benefits for basic, to me, it's just unconscionable. So I don't know how to respond, because I can't actually believe we do that in this country.
It is hard to believe. And yeah. And so I'm just sad because, you know, she stepped down because she couldn't get any traction on it, but then here kind of on the backside, but I just, you know, she worked really, really hard for 10 years, as far as I understand it. And, you know, maybe she wasn't in alignment with all of the other advocacy movements, but this woman was like a lone wolf warrior constantly pushing to get changes to the registry situation in Virginia, which my understanding isn't one of the better ones.
Well, I don't think that hardly anyone has a better one anymore, because they've all been tinkered with. Some are less horrible than others.
Yeah, that's all I mean by it. You know, some Florida and Alabama and Mississippi are, in from what I understand, some of the worst, particularly where Whatchamaduiki is down there in Broward County.
Yeah, and every state in the South thinks that theirs is the worst. Well, that's how I'm the worst state in the country. No, you're actually not. But so the
all right. Well, Ninth Circuit.
What's your problem with this? What's your problem with it?
Well, it's there was something that a president said that then it's going to go to the Ninth Circuit, and then it's going to go through this, and then it's going to go through this, and I can't even try and repeat all the things that he said. But so this Ninth Circuit is a
well,
a
he implied that anything go through the Ninth Circuit is not going to be handled correctly because it's a bunch of fanatical liberals out there. Simply not true, but that was the inference. This case is one that NARSL has been working on, and it It was one that we put a lot of resources into. I mean, a lot. It's relative to the resource you have. We don't have a lot of resources, but of the resources that we have, we put a lot of what we have into this particular challenge. It's one of those offenses where there's no mens rea required, and merely touching a child, a minor, on the wrong spot of their body is enough. That it doesn't have to be any sexual motivation shown by the prosecution to secure a conviction. That's referred to as burden shifting. And so the convicted person, Stephen May, served a number of years in prison. I've lost track of how many, 9, 10 years in prison on this thing, fighting it through the state courts. And then he finally went into the federal courts after exhausted his state court. He filed a habeas petition in the federal court. And he did the impossible. He won in federal habeas court. He won a sweeping decision by a U.S. district judge who declared the statute in Arizona to be unconstitutional, the child molestation statute. The judge ordered May immediately released, which also doesn't happen. So of course the state of Arizona is going to appeal when one of their statutes is declared unconstitutional. So they appealed it since they in the sixth or the ninth district, Ninth Circuit. I'll get it right here in a minute. That since they rest within the borders of the Ninth Circuit, U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, this case was assigned to a 3-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit Court, and the Ninth Circuit affirmed the district judge, except they affirmed him in a much more limited way. They affirmed his granting habeas relief, but they did not affirm him declaring the statute unconstitutional. They affirmed him on very limited grounds, which is very disappointing to us at NARSL. Now, we're happy that May, his conviction has been set aside, but it was set aside because of the jury had deadlocked and the jury had been discharged. And then after being discharged, they hung out and they said, hell, well, now you kind of make a pretty good point there. And they reconstituted themselves and began to deliberate again after they had been discharged and a mistrial had been declared. They announced that they had reached a verdict. And May's attorney did not object to them continuing deliberation. Of course, he said that it was a strategy that he felt like that their deliberation might result in an acquittal. So he was hoping his client would get acquitted. Well, his client got convicted in their sua sponte reconstituting continued deliberation. So the Ninth Circuit said, we affirm on that. That was fundamental error for the attorney not to object to the jury deliberating. Therefore, everything else goes down the crapper. There's no conviction. And it opens the door to potentially the state trying him again, and so it's very disappointing to us. But still, we're excited that he doesn't have a conviction at the moment. But we don't get to find out if the burden shifting in the Arizona statute is constitutional or not, because that was delayed for another day.
Remind me the burden shifting claim, what that entails.
Rather than the state having to prove that there was a sexual motivation for the touching. The defendant, kind of what we talked about earlier in the affirmative defense, the defendant could say, I did touch them, but it was not for a sexual motivation. And the defendant carried the burden. So there again, we've conveniently shifted the burden where it should not belong. The defendant should never have to prove anything.
The scenario that I'm thinking of is I don't know anything about this situation, so I'm just going to create a complete hypothetical. You have you're standing at the doorway to a school bus and you're going on a field trip, and as someone is climbing up on the bus, they go and they start falling, and you put your hands up to block them, and you end up grabbing a good handy fistful of cheeks, And that ends up, you like, there's, yes, I touched, but there was no motivation, no sexual intent behind it. And that's, so, I mean, like I said, completely hypothetical. I don't know what the real situation is, but that is sort of what we're talking about.
That is what we're talking about. And the of course, the average citizen would say, well, the police are overworked and understaffed, and the prosecution is overworked and understaffed, and nobody would ever bring a case like that. So that's just so ridiculous. It's too ridiculous to conceive. But although I haven't seen a case quite like that brought, I've seen some cases not too much different than that brought. Because if you're not required to prove anything, it's easier to bring a case. Now, in this case, the guy was at a, he worked at a pool, and the allegations were he was touching them as he was helping them out of the pool. And but he was saying it was in his capacity of helping, and the state was saying it was in your capacity of trying to grope. But we don't have to prove that. You have to prove, and that shouldn't be that way. It should be the other way, in my way of thinking. The state should have to prove that you touched the person because you wanted sexual arousal of either yourself or the person you were touching.
Interesting. All right. And then, so I'm assuming Arizona will then try to appeal this too, right?
I don't know that they will. I don't think that all the brilliant minds that are working, and there are smart people working on this case far smarter than I am. I don't think that they even understand what's potentially, because I asked Mr. May if the state could retry him, because I don't know enough about Arizona law, and he didn't know. And I said, well, does Erica, your attorney, know? And he said, no, she doesn't know. And he said, but they're trying to figure this out. And I said, well, if they can retry you, then there'd be a lot of considerations that they would that they must make whether they're going to retry you or not. We're talking about a person who is now 20, 21 years old. It was like 7 or 8 at the time. We're talking about a whole different circumstance. We don't know where this person is. If the Arizona is going to have to fly the person in from Hawaii, we don't know if she has her own kids now. And we don't know if she's, I mean, the cost of, we don't know if she's well connected. And the Arizona district, Maricopa County district attorney, whatever county it was in, is related to her, or if there's been significant campaign contributions. So the first question is, can they retry him? If there's anything that would bar him being retried because of the time he's already served, but can they retry him? And then if they can, will they retry him? And if they can't retry him, that would be ideal. If they will retry him, then he's got the potential to face having to make a deal on a plea again. Because if they have the ability to retry him, they're going to try to settle with coming out with some kind of conviction. They're not going to want to just let him walk away unless that's the only choice they have. They're going to want to secure a conviction for something.
And, is this double jeopardy?
No, it's not double jeopardy. Why would it be double jeopardy? He the only reason why his conviction is set aside is because of him. So he would be able to be tried again if the previous trial was faulty and it was set aside because of a mistake made. They could try him again.
Interesting. Well, I say double jeopardy because he already served the time, he was already convicted. But I guess since they squashed the conviction, then you could be tried again.
Well, that's where it begs the question of, like, if they were to convict him again, say they could try him again. Would they be limited to sentencing him to no more than what he was sentenced to the first time? Now, he got 60 years, and he hadn't served all of it.
Jesus.
Well, Arizona's tough.
That's pretty bad.
But if they can retry him, they're gonna push to do that, or try to force him to take a deal. Well, he's not going to take a deal this time around, unless it's a really sweet deal, which is no sex offense. I mean, if they were offering a misdemeanor conviction, not of a sexual nature, time served, go away and have a good life.
Right.
You'd be a foolish attorney not to advise someone to take that deal, because if you're facing the potential of going back to prison for what would be the rest of this man's life, you'd be a nut not to take that deal. But if he doesn't get a sweet enough offer, logically what he would do would be he would launch his constitutional challenge again. All over, because the statute as it was written at the time did not require, and I don't even think the affirmative defense was in there now that I look back, and I think that they've added the affirmative defense, but the statute that he would be tried under was the way the wording was at the time. if he were smart, and he is smart, he would challenge the statute on constitutional grounds, and maybe even do an interlocutory appeal if they permit that in Arizona, kind of like was done in Georgia, the case we talked about last week.
About the lifetime supervision,
the GPS
or GPS monitor. Yeah.
If he could do that, if he could knock this down. Now, the Arizona courts have not been particularly sympathetic to the burden shifting argument so far, but who knows? Times are changing.
Interesting. Wow. That's more than my brain can even process.
Well, to make it simple, we're disappointed we didn't get a ruling on the burden shifting on the constitutionality of the statute. That argument was stripped out, and they gave him the set aside of his conviction, the habeas relief on the very limited grounds of the ineffective assistance of counsel. And even there was a dissenting judge of the three on the panel that she didn't think he deserved the relief on that. She said that it was a wise strategy because attorneys are afforded broad discretion and strategy under the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act of 1996. She said that was a viable strategy. Therefore, that under ADPA, they were supposed to defer to the attorney's strategy decision. So she said, no dice. I dissent from giving him any relief at all. But two judges were in favor. So Arizona could conceivably ask for a full court review, or they could file a cert petition. I don't think they're going to do that, but they could. I think they're going to try to cut a deal.
You just used an acronym, I guess. ADPA. What is ADPA?
That's what I just said. The Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty.
Oh, gosh. You used. Okay, sorry. Again. I didn't realize that that's what that meant. Okay. Huh. Well, there we go.
And ADPA was a creation of the conservatives in 1996 when they had control of Congress to restrict state prisoners from going back into federal court over and over again and complaining about their state court convictions. So the needle is tough to thread under ADPA in terms of the hurdles and barriers they have and the extreme deference that's required to the state courts under ADPA. And that's something that we ended up bad public policy in 96. Clinton signed it because he didn't want to take the abuse of their reelection. I mean, who can be against the Anti-Terrorism and Effective Death Penalty Act after you had the Oklahoma City bombing? And that was what it was about. They wanted to put the federal death penalty was not broad enough that they were afraid that they couldn't put people to death. And so
can you imagine a presidential campaign having vetoed ADPA?
He would have been raked over the coals for sure.
Do you think Bob Dole would have said, Mr. President, I support you on vetoing that? Or do you think he would have been out there campaigning across the coast saying what a horrible president Clinton was for vetoing that? Which do you think he would likely have done?
Oh, they would totally have just raked him over the coals over it, which, I mean, they did anyway, but that's a different conversation.
So presidents sometimes get forced to sign stuff that they know better, but the politics don't permit that. 96 was an election year. He signed some bad stuff in 96, and I generally support the Clinton years, but he signed some stuff that I did not support. That was one of them. I didn't support the Glass-Steagall repeal. There were some things he did that were not so good.
I mean, see, now you said that all of our listeners are going to now evacuate since you said that part.
Well, they know that I'm a pointy head.
What was I just going to ask you?
Clinton was not a pointy head. He was a very centrist. He was not a pointy head at all.
Yes. We've also referenced where Obama signed the IML stuff, and that, you know, there was no way for him to not sign that.
Well, absolutely, and I still get ridiculed for that. Here we are again in 2016. People have forgotten when it happened. It was 2016, which was an election year for the president and for every member of the House of Representatives and one-third of the Senate. And yes, he did possess the power. He could have vetoed the legislation. But had he done that in a veto, the question is, do you want to uphold your executive or do you want to weaken your executive? So the only way you would win that would be Obama would have had to, as a lame duck president, he couldn't run for re-election. He would have had to gone and lobbied leadership in Congress because the Republicans were in control, and McConnell and Boehner for those who don't remember who the speaker was, would have been delighted to have overridden Obama because they had not been able to. And especially on something like protecting children from predators. So they would have immediately sought to override him. And Obama, as a lame duck, would have had to have been lobbying Democrats to please spare me enough votes so that I don't have the embarrassment of being overridden. And these are people they would be saying, well, Mr. Obama, let me make this clear. So you're a lame duck, and I'm facing re-election, and you're asking me to sustain your veto so that I can be tarred and feathered in my campaign. Have I got that straight, Mr. President?
Yes.
That's what would have happened. And beyond that, Obama didn't know there was anything wrong with the legislation because it passed unanimously. When it reached the Oval Office, as far as he was concerned, everybody looked at that and said, gee, there's no dissension on this. I mean, this is something where it went through like grease lightning. Right. So he would not have known there was anything wrong with it. And even if he had known, he would have been asking the Democratic caucus, because it takes a 2/3 majority. So he would have needed a significant number of Democrat votes. He wouldn't have gotten any Republican votes. They would have all voted in lockstep to override him. And he would have needed to jeopardize Democrats as a lame duck. That's not going to happen. Now, I don't make the rules for life. That's just the reality of what the situation was in 2016. It's not the way it should be, but it's the way it was.
Or the way it is be. Or the way it was.
Not is anymore, but that's not the, I tell people, I don't make these rules, but it's the reality of the situation. No sitting member that was holding office as a Democrat was going to vote against overriding the president on something that they were going to be ridiculed as much as they would have. This would have been his first veto override, and he would have been overridden anyway. And in the meantime, that would have been used as fodder all throughout the 2016 election cycle. Can you believe that Representative so-and-so voted with Obama to protect, to not protect child predators? Can you believe that?
Right.
It would have been a debacle. So that's the reason why the veto didn't happen. In addition to the fact he didn't know there's anything wrong with it. Nobody told him.
Right. Mike, I know it's kind of on the spot and you probably didn't get it. You didn't know about this coming up on the podcast. Do you have any questions?
Yeah. Well, I understand exactly what you guys are talking about. And what Larry's saying is it really boils down to human nature. And my question, listening to all that, is Larry, do you see any kind of change? Do you think it's ever going to change? I mean, these guys obviously want to get elected, and nobody likes to be ridiculed, especially on a national platform. And with politicians running campaigns the way they do now, instead of running on their achievements and laurels, it's pretty much a mud fest when they, you know, run each other down as hard as they can. Do you see that? Is that likely ever to change?
I don't think that we're going to be, unless we changed our system altogether. I think that the hope would be for change for people to better understand how the system works. And a part of what happened in that particular instance was we didn't have resources in D.C. at the national level to actually be trying to work against this. And IML had been presented for years and years, for several years, when the Democrats controlled Congress, and there were some key Democrats in the committee process, particularly on the Senate side, that would not let this bill make it to the final floor. If it makes it to the full floor for a final vote, it's going to pass, regardless of whether the Democrats or Republicans are controlling. But it never could get out of the committee and make it to the floor. When the Republicans took over in 2014, they won the 2014 control of the Senate. Then all of a sudden, all the chairmanships shifted to the Republican Party, and the majority on the committee shifted to the Republican Party. And what had been stalled in Senate Judiciary was able to get out of Senate Judiciary finally because the Republicans had control. So how it changes is for us to understand there are consequences for what we do and how we vote. And we didn't have people who understood that those consequences were going to be as draconian as they were when that shift took place. And then at the national level, if we had resources in D.C. working in those halls of Congress, we could probably be more effective, but we don't. I mean, we truly, that's an area where I wish we had resources, but we don't. I mean, the NARSL budget, I would hate to say what it is on the podcast, but it's so paltry that it's pathetic. And it would cost $50,000 a year at least to have a part-time lobbyist.
I mean, if you're going to have somebody at D.C. for Congress being in session year round, we don't have that kind of money. I do have hope that things will change, but that hope is tempered by the reality as I see people voting in a less and less sophisticated way, and I see people disappoint me time and time again. You know, I constantly spew about things that disappoint me. You know, I've been on this budget deficit rampage now. I mean, we're 5 months into the fiscal year. They just put the 5 month figures out of the fiscal year. We set a record budget deficit for the history for 1 month for the entire country of 248 to 264 billion dollars in 1 month of February, and we're up 77% in the 5 months over the previous, you know, the same corresponding 5 months the previous year, which was up about 50% over the previous fiscal year. I mean, the deficit is going off of the stratosphere, out of the stratosphere, with what supposedly the best economy we've seen in 50 years or 100 years or whatever it is they say, with full employment. There's no gushing tax revenue. The revenues are actually flat, and spending is up 9%. I wish the people that are voting would actually look at those numbers and say, well, now I heard in the campaign about how we're going to be frugal and responsible with spending, and yet spending is up 9% in 1 year. And I heard in the campaign that they said that we're going to have gushing tax revenue, and tax revenues are flat overall, and corporate tax revenues are down something like 37%. But that has been offset by individual tax receipts, which are up slightly because there are more people working. But federal revenues are flat. They're not gushing. And spending is going up at three times the rate of inflation. I wish people, rather than just being so glued to their partisan to their partisan positions, would look at that and say, what they say is not what they're doing. And once they start asking those questions, perhaps they'll start voting slightly differently. That's what we're hoping to accomplish. One of the things on this podcast is to get our people to carefully analyze the impact of their votes and who they're supporting and what policies they're supporting.
Well, all right, Larry. Let's take you off that soapbox. And I totally forgot to add this at the beginning of the show. We do have a new patron, and our new patron is named Carrie. So thank you so very much for becoming a patron. And I look forward to having your support, and hopefully we can deliver a product that you enjoy. And I definitely want to thank all of our patrons. Go ahead.
And how do we get more of them? Because we keep telling people to do their gross or their net pay, and they're not doing that. So what if, Mike, are you willing to be the first one to do your gross pay or your net pay?
Oh, you know, I know how I could help significantly. I'm going to talk to my wife about cutting her Starbucks budget.
And pretty soon sweet.
Can get a lobbyist. We'll be able to lobby in every state in the country.
I'll tell you what, though, the guy who's I can't think of the guy, the Starbucks president's name, but he, you know, he's running for president. He's probably not going to be happy if you cut out that part of the budget.
I'll tell you, he's going to take a hit if my wife stops buying Starbucks.
That's so funny to me because I think I said maybe on this podcast, maybe not. I've never spent a dime at Starbucks. Now I have had dimes spent on me at Starbucks for people who want to go to Starbucks, but I have never bought any of their overpriced coffee. And I think it's kind of humorous that they've convinced people that they're willing to pay $5 and $6 yes. and $7 and $9 for a cup of coffee, but they do.
Yep.
And but people are spending hundreds of dollars a month. I work for one on Starbucks, and it just blows my mind.
Well, one of our listeners in chat said, "Sex offenders can't get good jobs due to discrimination, so we can't afford to do that." So
well, you know, we're joking about the gross or net pay. Yes. So nobody's expected to do that, or even that's not a serious thing. But those who do have a little income stream, if a buck was or anything above a dollar would be in your budget, that would be greatly appreciated.
And so since we're running long, let's get this thing shut down. Mike, do you know what the website is? All right, I'm not going to call you out. So registrymatters.co. That's how you.
Okay, because I was going to say .org. You know, the phone number. Wrong.
No. It's totally it's a .co. It's not even a .com. Gotcha.
And then
do you know what the phone number is?
And then the most important way. We get from people like Will and some others is you call and leave try to make it shorter than 8 minutes. Try to keep it 1 to 2 minutes. 747-227-4477.
You have to know the email address, Mike.
Don't.
All right. No. Registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And then, so Larry, what is the, what's the best way to support the podcast?
To go to patreon.com. Oh, it's patreon.com/registrymatters.
Patreon.
I love playing with, who is it that says Patreon? One of our good friends.
I totally don't want to call him.
I just say one of our good friends.
He thought for probably like 10, maybe 15 episodes that it was Patreon.
Oh, but he's one of our dear friends.
And he gave me the whole grammatical. Yeah, he is. And he gave me like the whole grammatical. Well, when this letter is before this and after that, I was like, man, I don't know what to tell you about all that. It's the same as a patron. Anyway, yeah. So it's Patreon.
As long as you're supporting, call it what you want.
That's right. It's like, yes, your, it's like your really name care. When we had chief of staff in the Carter administration named Hamilton Jordan, J-O-R-D-A-N. His name was pronounced Jordan. And a person's name is whatever they say it is.
Well, Mike, thank you so very much for joining us. I really appreciate it. We had a good time, and you are welcome on anytime.
Absolutely.
Far as
thank you.
I don't know about Larry.
I appreciate it.
Well, glad to have you here. Appreciate you coming in. Appreciate your long support.
Sure. And I'm going to keep in touch with Andy. And if there's anything I can do to help and support, I absolutely will do so within my means.
Gross or net, man. That's all we ask. Gross or net.
Hey, man. I'll see what I can do. I'll see what I can do about that. Sorry,
or
we'll take
or
care.
Since you're reaching retirement age, just do a direct deposit of your Social Security.
Hey, that works too.
I'm not there yet, Larry. I got a while.
Well, take care, guys. I appreciate it so very much. Thank you, Larry. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks. Good night.
Thank you for joining us here at FYP, and we hope you will join us again on our next broadcast.